read a story tonight on CNN that McCartney was on stage with Bruce Springsteen in London earlier tonight. They're doing a big old concert in an outdoor London park. It's Springsteen's concert, but McCartney comes on and joins him for several encore numbers. They just did I Saw Her Standing There. The crowd's going crazy. They leap into Twist and Shout, and the crowd again is rocking along. And some bureaucrat from the City of London comes over, flips the switch, and turns off the power and says, sorry, folks, you went too long. We told you your permit only allows you to go till such and such hour, and we're turning it off. Well, the crowd went nuts. I guess the artists were all pretty mad, and you can understand why. That's the way it goes, the power of bureaucrats. Switching gears now, is it possible to investigate the paranormal and still be reasonable, to be appropriately skeptical, but not so skeptical that you refuse to fairly examine the evidence, no matter where it leads? Our guest tonight is a mainstream journalist, one of the few in the country who has covered the courts, the cops, and politics, and all the other stuff that regular reporters cover, but still had the requisite curiosity and courage to, as I called it earlier, jump into the deep end of the pool by delving into the paranormal and the supernatural. And they're not really the same thing. How science and journalism and the rest of us approach these subjects. Steve Volk asks the kind of questions that I think need to be asked, and he makes a strong case that serious investigation into these areas is justified, that something really is going on. Although he stops short of any hard and fast conclusions because the evidence just doesn't lead that far, sort of what journalists are supposed to do, but don't. His book is called Fringeology. It's a great read for anyone interested in these subjects, very broad in scope, and when we come back, we'll jump right into the thick of it. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Steve Volk has been working as a big city reporter since 1997, as I mentioned, covering all the stuff that big city reporters cover, crime and cops, courts, politics, education, both in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, has been writing a lot for Philadelphia Magazine, and wrote an excellent book called Fringeology that is now just now out in paperback. Steve, great to have you on the show.
Hey, George, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. You know, whenever I find a journalist who goes as far into these subjects as you have, I have to start with the question, what in the world were you thinking? Because this is generally not something that really helps one's journalism career.
No, it's not. And for me, and it's funny that when I did some publicity for this earlier, I didn't jump right into mentioning this because it's very personal. And so I leaned rather heavily on talking about this family ghost story that I grew up with, but there was and that was in a lot of ways my motivation to start to look into this. We had a ghost in our house when I was a kid, but it was my mom's death that made me even start thinking about that again. And it's an interesting thing to think about how we sort of progress through this world. You know, you grow up and you have this strange thing that goes on in your house, and for a while that can really help inform your worldview. But then, you know, after I became an adult and I became a reporter and I'm dealing in facts and court documents and trying to back things up with scientific studies or whatever it takes to report a story, I just wasn't thinking about these things so much anymore. Ghosts, UFOs, they were just way off my radar. And then actually I had a brother-in-law die. He was very, very close to me, very much like a brother. He died of cancer, and then 2 years later my mom died of cancer. I was at the bedside for both deaths, and it just got me thinking about much bigger subjects. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, who's the hot candidate on city council to run for mayor next is nowhere near as important as what happens when we die. And I decided that if I didn't start using my journalistic skills to look into some of those things, I'm just kind of doing a disservice.
Well, I know what you mean. I know what you mean also about after you've covered it, it's really hard to go back to cover in the zoning board or a city council meeting. You go chasing after Area 51 or UFOs or government cover-ups, or in your case, all of that and a lot more, you know, ghosts, life after death, near-death experiences. Do I go down and see if the dog catcher is going to show before the city council? It's hard to get up for that, isn't it?
Well, yeah. You know, it's funny for me, is at least as a feature writer doing deep dives, as they say, on every story. I mean, 4,000 words, 5,000 words. I get to spend time with something and really, you know, think about the ways in which it's important, or reflect on, you know, the deeper meaning of any person's story. But you're still right. even with that advantage, where I'm not churning out the 500-word story on the latest city council meeting, even with that advantage, I do find myself having a hard time getting the same energy level up for these stories that I did for the book. I'll tell you right now, you know, the one thing that's captivated my energy since I got back in a really full way, I'm doing a long story on the violence in Philadelphia. And it's a beautiful town. Unfortunately, it's also a very violent town. And it's those life or death stakes, right, that enable me to invest in that as much as I invested in Fringeology.
Well, these topics, you know, are far more important than you would think, than the mundane stuff of day-to-day life. What happens to us after we die? Is there a consciousness that prevails, that continues on? What is our place in the universe? Are there other people out there? Those are big, very important, critical questions, but they're not as immediate as the day-to-day stuff about how much gas costs and how I'm going to pay the mortgage and whether I'm being foreclosed on.
Yeah, well, and they're not immediate until it's 3 a.m. and you're up by yourself at night, you know?
Yeah.
They're not immediate until you're by your mom's bedside, and there's that helpless feeling because you know where this is headed, and there's nothing you can do to stop it. And that's when it becomes immediate, and you start to realize, well, wait a second, this is the sort of thing, and it's funny, you know, some of the stuff that didn't make it into the book, you know, I did a lot of research in different religious traditions, and that sense of preparation for that time of everyone's life, the preparation for what it's going to be like when I'm lying in that bed. It's an important thing to undertake, and I think it's something we miss a lot in this society. And so, you know, a lot of what Fringeology for me is anyway, I think that people can take away from it, it becomes a kind of primer here for dealing with your own existential crises and your own times of waking up at 3 a.m. and wondering what it's all about. Unfortunately, that end we're all coming to.
Well, I want to get into the whole idea about that, where you would discuss Elizabeth Kubler-Ross near-death experiences and what it tells us about our own mortality. One more question first, though, about the journalism profession. And I just wanted to know if there have been any repercussions for you since the book came out.
You know, George, the repercussions were more before the book came out. I had a lot of stories coming back to me from friends about people, you know, sort of whispering about me and what I was up to and whether or not, in a sense, I would ever make it back into, you know, the regular world, as it were, and have a job. And since the book's come out, I have to say, I would encourage other people to go ahead and feel good about diving into this. The water is warm enough. I think I did a responsible job of reporting on it. And it's shown through in the way people have responded to it. I'm back with a full-time job at the magazine. They gave me a window office, which I didn't have before. So everything seems to be going just fine. And, George, I'd be remiss before we dive into the book if I didn't say to you, your existence on the planet is one of the things that helped me get the courage up to do the book at all. The fact that there was an investigative reporter out of Vegas who is, you know, also on coast and had a foot so squarely in both worlds, just made me think, you know what, this is possible. I'm going to go ahead and do it.
Well, thank you. But it is possible, and you can come back, and you can still do both, as long as you try to walk, well, not too fine of a line, but at least walk, be a little bit careful in how far over the side you go. You know, in this program, we try to explore these topics. We give people a chance to express their voices on subjects that are considered crazy. I think I read your book today. I think you do an excellent job of walking the middle ground and arguing for not too much extremism on both sides, because in the course of your research, you found that that's exactly what exists on all these topics. The hopelessly gullible nuts who accept everything as an alien or a UFO from another planet, or they think every flick or speck of dust in a photo is a ghost or an orb on one side, and then the absolute religious zealots on the other side. And I call them religious zealots because they call themselves scientists, but that's what they are, as you note. They're zealots who won't accept anything.
Yeah, and I hope we get to this at some point tonight. I mean, I reserve a lot of my ire for the skeptical class, because they're truly not skeptics. They're engaged in a propaganda war for the most part, and they're very, very comfortable in what they believe. In whatever facts appear to the contrary, they just try to roll right over them.
Well, let's start there. Let's start there, because you do take them to task on several levels, both in the area of psychic research, UFO research, near-death experiences, and you've got a lot of examples. One of them is James Randi, who's should be well-known, a name well-known to listeners to this program, the amazing Randi, some say the amusing Randi, arch-skeptic, arch-debunker, who's had this challenge, this paranormal challenge for a lot of years. Well, he'll give you a lot of money if you can prove him wrong. And you have a lot of interesting stuff in the book, and you've written other stuff since then.
Well, it's important to understand where Randy's concerned in this million-dollar challenge he's been pumping for years and years, that it's not what it seems to be. And what you find with Randi in general is that every aspect of him, it seems, turns out to be not quite what it seems to be. So he comes on as he is the truth teller. He is the guy who shows you how to sort out the wheat from the chaff, the real from the imagined. And it turns out that he's a bit more of a propagandist. And so back to the million-dollar challenge, when you look at the way that thing's constructed, the kinds of odds that he demands people hit. So he has a psychic in there, and they're supposed to prove their abilities. And he asks for a level of proof far beyond what is normally considered statistically significant in science. And that's not the kind of fact he goes around valuing about his challenge, that I'm asking for something far beyond what an ordinary scientist would ask for. And so there's a kind of deception involved there. And then you compound that, if you look really closely at the roster of people who've tried out for the Million Dollar Challenge, there are appearances of people who I just think that from the view of the parapsychological community, nobody would have expected them in a bajillion years to come up with significant results. In other words, he's probably let some people in over the years who really were just kind of going for a money grab as if they were playing the lottery. And they didn't have any, sort of a real commitment to the field or any kind of established track record of talent in the area. And so if you just sort of start there, the million-dollar challenge isn't what it seems to be. But one of the things I've written about since then on my website, and I think this is what you were referring to, is that Randy's a complicated guy. He's been into a dust-up recently in Florida where he lives. James Randi came out as he's a gay man a few years ago, and I certainly have no problems with that. But it turns out that the man who has been his life partner, who was going by the name of Jose Luis Alvarez, has been a very significant guy in James Randi's career. He posed as Carlos, a channeler, in a tour that Randi did, particularly in Australia, where they traveled overseas, and the whole idea was that they were going to, quote, create a psychic and show how easy it was to fool people. And he's gone on and on for years talking about what a success Carlos was. But it's funny, if you look back to the Carlos affair, that isn't true either. The media uniformly routed Carlos when he showed up. They didn't buy that this was a real psychic. People in the audience, the majority, seemed dissatisfied. I mean, there's been some research done into this. But that hasn't prevented Randi from going on and talking about how successful it was. Moreover, it turns out that Jose Luis Alvarez, Randy's partner in this thing, who is purportedly out to expose frauds, was himself guilty, we now can say this, guilty of identity theft. He had stolen the identity of Jose Luis Alvarez. It turns out his name was Davy Pena, and he was from Venezuela. He was an illegal. And, back in the 80s, it was a lot harder, I think, to steal someone's ID than it is now. And the question sort of remains, James Randi hasn't really answered it yet. What did he know? When did he know it? I'm deeply interested in the answer to that question, because the idea that, the skeptical truth teller was out there exposing frauds with a guy who was committing fraud just boggles the mind.
Yeah, I guess it becomes relevant in that he's lived with a guy for 20 years, and he's out there as the cop on the beat. He puts himself out as the truth teller, the guy who exposes all the fraudsters and the guy you can trust to tell you the truth about this stuff. And he obviously has not been telling the truth for a very long time. I mean, he really is way out in front of the pack on on this psychop ultimate debunker stuff, isn't he?
He is. I hate to use this sort of terminology, but he's kind of their pope. I mean, he's the guy they revere the most. And it's funny how skeptics that I've spoken to just so refuse to acknowledge the fundamental importance of what went on in the Carlos affair, the fundamental importance of the way in which the $1 million challenge is sort of willfully misrepresented as being far more authoritative a test than it actually is.
I want to say real quick,
sure. I think your cop analogy is really powerful to me, because for me as a reporter, and you can probably relate to this, there's nothing worse in the world than a crooked cop. There's just nothing worse. And it's the same sort of hypocrisy you get, sort of in religion, when you have somebody who's a priest, but they're committing crimes. There's something that makes people, rightfully so, I think, really, really angry about that. And so I think the reason that my ire gets up so much with the skeptical community is that they're purporting to be something they're not, and they do it again and again. And they're guilty of the same kind of hypocrisy that they accuse the religious of all the time. And the problem with that is, skeptical thinking and scientific thinking is important, but
yes,
these guys aren't good spokespeople for it.
You make the point in the chapter about telepathy that PsyCop, speaking of cops, PsyCop, the organization, the skeptical organization, changed its name. It's now just CSI, where it takes the science out of its title. And of course, James Randi was part of this thing. And one of the examples you use, specifically, again, talking about Randi, was this girl, this psychic, who could psychically evaluate medical diseases, medical issues. I guess the goalpost keeps moving, that she had seven people that she evaluated, and she got four of them right, but that wasn't enough.
Yeah, to meet his standards, she had to get one more right.
Five out of seven.
She had to get five out of seven, and I forget what the statistics were on that, George, but I mean, it's odds against chance is what he's going for. And she wasn't quite there, even though four out of seven is just hugely robust. And to give the skeptics a small break, there's a guy named Chris French who, when you call the skeptics on their own bad behavior, he's usually the first to go ahead and admit it. But even him, it seems to me, you've got to twist his arm. There's a real kind of cabal feel about what they're up to, in that they have, to them, I think there's a kind of the ends justify the means stance that they take. And so I don't think that they play fair, because they think that ultimately advancing the cause of scientism or materialism is so important that nothing else, everything else pales in comparison.
Well, there's an example you use in the book when there was a discussion or disagreement between PsyCop and the researchers who came up with this thing called the Mars effect. And it turns out they looked at it, they studied it, and darn if there wasn't a statistically significant basis for the so-called Mars effect, and they wouldn't publish the study, because the quote you use is, "We can't let the mystics rejoice."
Yeah, Dennis Rollins, to his credit, he was part of PsyCop, and he wanted to see them publish it because he actually believed in the scientific method. He believes in fair play, right, and believed in honoring your agreements, and so he wanted to see it published. The guys at PsyCop refused. And it was Randi that he attributes this quote to in a writing that he did, and then I use in the book, that when he pushed Randi, why not just tell the truth and be done with it and move on? Randy's reply, he said, was ever the same. We can't let the mystics rejoice. And I think that it's really important that people understand this. It's really important that people understand that when the media, generally speaking, looks into a situation like this, George, they get a dean laid in or somebody to speak up for parapsychology, and then they go get somebody from CSI, right, from the Randi crowd. And we need to be deeply skeptical of any word that comes out of their mouth. It's really that simple.
Great advice, Steve Volk. As mentioned, Steve has some family history in the area of ghost research. We're going to get into that. Let him tell the story of how he became interested in this and where it led. It's a heck of a tale if you haven't heard it. Stay with us, everyone. Much more Coast to Coast to come. We're talking with Steve Volk, author of the book Fringeology. A new paperback version is out, and he covers a heck of a lot of ground, including his own family experiences that really led him to write this book. We'll get into the ghost story from the Volk family right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Steve Volk, before we get into your family ghost story, I want to do some definitions of terms, because it's an important distinction that you make in the book, a distinction between paranormal and supernatural. We often use those terms interchangeably. I think I've probably been guilty of it myself, but you make a distinction between them. Can you explain it?
Yeah, you know, and it's funny, one of the very first things I did in writing this book is I started going through dictionaries to try and figure out, well, what are we talking about when we talk about the paranormal and the supernatural? And I kept coming across similar sorts of phrases where if you look at definitions for supernatural, you see things like of or relating to an order of existence beyond the visible, observable universe, and a lot of times an emphasis on God, something like of or relating to God or a god, demigod, spirit, or devil. So you have all those religious connotations, and so all those cultural conflicts that come up with that are going to enter into the conversation. But when you look at the word paranormal, it's often defined, usually in fact, in much more useful terms, I think, of or pertaining to events or perceptions occurring without scientific explanation. There's no assertion there that we can't explain this. There's no assertion there that that a good faith effort to figure out what the source of this is won't yield some sort of result. And so I think that, unfortunately, these two words have become sort of conjoined, where supernatural, which means beyond explanation, beyond any possible explanation, and paranormal, which does offer the hope that an investigation will be fruitful, are unfortunately being used interchangeably. And I think there's a lot of paranormal topics that sort of end up being sullied by this.
As you mentioned, and you know, there's a really steep learning curve in this stuff, and it's hard to be a journalist and just cover UFOs without delving far afield from that into ghosts and PSI and remote viewing, and all of that stuff sort of helps you with the larger understanding of this strange world. I know that my own views have changed many times since I started years ago and evolved, and this learning curve, it always seems steep no matter how long you spend in this. I'm just wondering, do you get the feeling as you look at the broad expanse of the topics that you cover in this book, Fringeology, that they're all related at some level, that there is another world where all these things coexist and they're not paranormal, they're normal?
Yeah, there is this weird sense that you develop, and it's like an intuitive sort of knowing, when we may get to that phrase again later, that you just sort of develop or get a feel for where these things do relate. And my sense of it, George, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, is it's like there's this realm where the subjective and the objective meet, and both occur and are both equally real. I mean, we normally think of the subjective as kind of an internal conscious experience or processing of experience. And then the objective realm is, you know, the desk that's in front of me right now and the computer monitor and the things that we can touch and mutually agree upon that they're both here. Well, it seems to me that in the paranormal, you get a conflation of these things. And normally that would make people say, well, yeah, the subjective part of it doesn't count for as much, but I'm not so sure anymore that that's true. I believe that those subjective experiences are equally real, and somehow it's as if, I guess the term the imaginal is used a lot, right, becomes real in a paranormal experience.
You ever get the feeling that maybe the learning curve is on purpose, that it's supposed to be that way, that it's the journey that counts and not getting to the end and figuring things out? I ask it in this context, as I wrote about this, co-wrote a book about this area of Utah,
yeah,
where a lot of strange stuff happened. I mean, it was almost like somebody went down a laundry list. Okay, UFOs, ETs, yeah, cattle mutilations, ghosts, angry poltergeists, all kinds of weird stuff, all in the same general area, as if it's trying to tell us these are all linked somehow. It's up to you to figure it out.
Two things. Number one, I read that book and I'd like to go.
Yeah, you and a million other people.
Yeah, I'd like to go. So that's number one. Number two, Yeah, you start to get that sense too that somehow this has been set up. And I have a story actually, sort of semi-related to that, from a hospice worker, where, and I'll do a short version of this. We might do more with this later, but this woman told her nurse that her sister was in the room and was waiting to take her away, and it was going to happen soon. And she said, and she just turned to her really matter-of-factly and said to her nurse, "I can see her. You can't. That's just the way it works." Real matter-of-factly, like, this is just how it is. And she, through these ongoing contacts with her sister who was coming into her hospice room, was becoming aware of this. That's just how it works. And so you have that sense that there's something, for some reason, a fuller understanding of this lays just beyond our ability.
But that the idea of the journey itself, that we're being asked to go ahead and pursue it, that somebody or something wants us to go down this road of inquiry?
Well, I'll tell you what, George, I think that if you, you know, to me, over the scope of this book, by the time people get to the end of it, I think they can see that the journey is hugely powerful, and the journey is, in some respects, does seem to be the point. I'm a very different person now than I was when I started the reporting. I think I'm just as skeptical. I certainly want a higher level of evidence than the believer friends I've met appear to need. And that's why I remain in this position where I'm awaiting further evidence. But I am no longer the same guy. And I like who I am better now. And yeah, it's left me with the sense that, well, you know, maybe that's the point. Maybe this is set up that way.
Let's talk about ghosts. The family ghost story started as you growing up, the house that your family lived in. What kinds of things you were experiencing?
Yeah, I was around 5 or 6 years old, so my memories of this are a little bit fragmentary. They're a child's memories. But I ended up interviewing all of my family members about this over the years, and it's funny to look back at this, because even before I became a reporter and had a thought of becoming a reporter, I mean, at that time in my life, George, early 20s, when I first started to press this with, you know, my older brother and my sisters and my parents and other relatives to see if my family had shared the story with them. At that point, I wanted to be a fiction writer, and I was doing this just out of a bout of personal interest. But it's funny looking back now that I ended up, you know, becoming a journalist and being able to use those interviews and the ones, of course, I subsequently did to write about this. But there was a banging. And at first, it doesn't sound terribly dramatic, right? But there was a banging that would go on, and it was always late at night, and it was really loud. So us, my brother and I and my sisters on the second floor, we heard it as a kind of almost like the house is coming apart sort of feeling to it. You know, I mean, it was that big. And to my brother and I, it seemed like it was coming from directly above us, the roof over our heads. Our sisters thought, and we didn't share an adjoining wall with them, that it was coming from somewhere high up in the wall of their room and sometimes the roof as well. And my parents, all the way downstairs in, you know, the master bedroom, we get woken up by this thing too. And to them, they just figured there was a sound on the roof. And it would go on for a long, long time. So what ended up happening is, you know, people look at these sorts of stories or hear these sorts of stories and think, well, right away, these guys, they get a weird noise and they leap to the idea that it's a ghost. No. My parents were dismissive of this thing for at least the first month or two. And then it just kept waking them up, and so they were irritated by it, and they started looking for prosaic explanations.
Plumbing,
you know, the water hammer is the one that I traditionally get from people. You had a water hammer. Well, nobody just turned on the water. There was no, you know, sudden stopping of water that creates that sound. There was no plumbing noise they could find that would account for a noise that went on so long and so loud and so high up. The water pipes, I mean, my dad, he's told me actually even since the book came out, he's been stressing this to me, that he's like, look, you know, we looked at how high up the pipes went in the walls on the second floor. I mean, there was no conceivable explanation coming from the plumbing. And then you compound this with there was more than banging, right? My sisters complained of some really dramatic things going on in their room. They complained that the sheets and blankets on their bed would get ripped away from them at night and just fall there in a heap at the foot of their beds. They claimed an old woman appeared in the bedroom and walked through a closed door. They claimed that their bed sometimes would shake in unison at night, and they said it was just as if somebody had grabbed both the bedposts and was twisting the bed left and right. Now, again, to show how deeply skeptical my parents were, they really didn't engage with that part of the story. I mean, they acknowledged it. They tried to keep my sisters calm, but they really focused on that sound. And I can still remember them one night after it happened. One of them would go upstairs, the other one would stay downstairs, and they would try to recreate the noise in various ways, opening and closing closet doors, banging on different things, and they could not come up with an explanation. And so this goes on for 9 months or a year. Anxiety levels, I guess, are only heightening at this point. And my father my parents decide that they're going to tell the family priest. We were practicing Catholics at that point. We are no longer, but we were then. And he goes and tells the priest. And I still love this part, George. The priest said to him, you know, well, in cases like this, what I usually do is come over and bless the house. And I love that because, you know, in cases like this, so,
yeah.
You know, the whole implication is there's a protocol that this guy has developed.
Yeah, wait, what did you say, priest? What, in cases like this? How many are there? Yeah,
exactly. And so he comes over, and this is not an exorcism. This is far from an exorcism. He didn't want to invoke sort of that kind of red tape in the church. And so he came over to just bless the house. And I remember this very vividly because, you know, when you're a kid and you see that priest on the altar giving communion, the ritual of that is very, very impressive. And so to have this guy now in my house, in his vestments, with incense and holy water, it made quite an impression. And so he comes through the house, he's praying in Latin, he's throwing holy water in the corners. And when he left, he said to my dad, Jerry, I'm sure everything will be fine. And it was really ended up being a point of irony to this, because that night, in fact, things were worse than ever. The banging went on longer and louder than ever. My parents, for the first time on the first floor, were thinking of it in terms of, you know, the house is going to come apart. And they ran out of their bedrooms. They were considering leaving for the night, literally like packing a bag and taking us to a hotel. And I start to laugh about this because it's like, you know, this is years before the movie Poltergeist, right? This is before Amityville Horror. They're thinking of getting us out of there for the evening. And then the noise did something it had never done before. So, George, I mean, up until that point, it operated in a completely, terrifically mindless fashion, right? Just boom, boom, thud, boom. And now suddenly it assumed a precise location and it moved. It hit at the top of the stairs.
Hey, let me interrupt you, Steve, and set the stage a little bit for this. You hear this story in detail, this part of the story, from your parents as an adult.
Yeah.
And they tell you this story in a setting where you can see on their faces they are very serious about it.
Oh, yeah, they wanted to stop. It was very clear to me they wanted to stop telling the story because it upset them that much. But they went through it, and they reached across the table and held each other's hands as they were recounting this, because they really looked sickened by it. It's not too big a word. And I asked them, and they said, you know, it's very stressful to remember this night because it was traumatic. There was this noise hits at the top of the stairs, and then it started coming down one step at a time. And my father had a very colorful description of it. He said it sounded like a child hitting one step after the other as hard as they could, you know, throwing a tantrum. But it would be a huge child making a noise this big, because he says he could feel the floor vibrate with these steps. And he actually stepped forward in front of the family because he thought he was going. At this point, we'd all run downstairs. We were now behind my parents. And he thought he was going to have to literally defend his family from there's no other word to put to it in our culture, but, you know, ghost. And when it hit the bottom step, it did so with a terrifically huge thud. Everything shook, and that was it. We actually never heard it again.
But that's not the end of the story for this house. And I don't know how much of this you want to give away, but you wait. You know, you hear this story from your parents. You remember part of it as a kid. Then as an adult, you ask your parents to recall it. They're obviously still upset 20 years later, holding hands across the table and kind of shaking a little bit into recalling it. And then as a postscript to this, you want to find out, well, is it only us or did something else happen to other people who lived in that house? Do you want to tell that?
I'll tell a little bit of it. I mean, there's always that impetus, right? I mean, my wife and I actually are even about to have twins, our first children. So, of course, I want people to buy the book.
Yeah.
I want to give you what you want here. And so, yeah, I went and looked at the people and talked to the people who lived in the house since we had. And I found that the current owners did not want to talk. And they were there was a very kind of sketchy quality to that. I mean, George, you know, when you're a reporter, you know when somebody has more to say, and they're not saying it.
Sure.
And I had that sensation from them the whole time. I didn't feel, you know, they were like, well, number one, nothing's happening, but number two, we wouldn't tell you if it was the way he put it, because he feels like you give these things power when you talk about them. This is the man in the house talking about it. And man, that sounded... I did some ghost hunting for this book, and that sounded so much like exactly like what I heard the guy I go on these hunts with tell his clients all the time, that you shouldn't talk about this thing. It gives it power. You shouldn't even think about it. It gives it power. And so I found that intriguing. But then the family that was in the house directly after us and was gone from it, I guess maybe they felt more liberated, I don't know, they told me stories about what happened in their house. And intriguingly, I'll share this part of it. The noise now took place on the first floor. And I found that really funny because, you know, it had been on the second floor the whole time, and then it had come downstairs and stopped. Well, when they moved in the house, there was now a noise on the first floor. And George, can I tell you my takeaway from all this?
Sure.
I don't know what the heck that was.
Yeah.
I don't know what it was. I don't know what happened. If people want to ask me about ghosts, we have to get into a whole big conversation then of what do we mean by ghost. It's complicated, and I think that the first step we need to take as a sort of society and a culture here is not to try and put some overlay, whether it be from you know, religion, and I understand it could be valuable and powerful. I myself started attending a Quaker church after doing this project, after doing this book. So I understand how powerful that can be, but don't bring any overlay to it. Just sort of at first acknowledge this is a complicated thing. It was a series of sounds that behaved, as I said before, in a very mindless way, but then at the end seemed to be responding to what had happened that day and actually moved. And that is really dramatic, and I am not aware, and I looked, of a prosaic explanation for this. I mean, the idea of a mass hallucination that my mother and my father, my sisters and brother and I all imagined these things just doesn't really hold water. And I think until somebody can show me an experiment in which you could induce this sort of hallucination in people, they're just yammering. Right. It's just a theory. There's just an idea there. I think we need to sit with that mystery that a story like this creates.
Well, I've said this before. I've used the line before. It's the duty of science and journalism to investigate the unexplained, not to explain the uninvestigated. And the fact that that you don't leap to conclusions based on the evidence you had is a feather in your cap. It's what journalists are supposed to do. It's what scientists should do, but don't. We continue our conversation with Steve Volk, author of the new book, Fringeology, right after this on Coast to Coast AM.